Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition, friends and family edition. Because, hey, Noel's here. Noel's part of the show. Why not have him on? I've talked to him about it. And I've wanted to interview Noel as a regular interview Friday guest for a while now. And the schedule's aligned, and I was texting with him. I was like, what movie are you going to pick? I was really kind of intrigued because Noel has great taste. And he came back to me with Adaptation, which made me very, very happy. One of my favorite movies. Really just really fun to sit down and watch this movie again. I've seen it so many times. But to watch just the master craftsmanship of Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze at work on their second collaboration after Being John Malkovich, another movie I love that we also talk about a little bit. So I talked to Noel about his life, really interesting upbringing with his opera singer parents and growing up some in Germany and being a creative, talented person from a very young age. Noel's done it all, everybody. We talk about that and more in this episode. So here we go with Noel Brown on Adaptation. My experience with Augusta has been pretty limited.
Yeah.
Very limited. I had a friend, one of my best friends growing up and then roommate in college, transferred to Georgia from USC Aiken, which is, I guess, right there, right?
Yeah, sure.
Aiken is
it's just in Aiken.
Over the border.
Well, Augusta is like weird because there's Augusta, Georgia, and then there's a bridge in downtown Augusta that leads you to South Carolina,
right,
to a town called North Augusta, which makes, you know, not much sense.
No, it
but
does.
Then it kind of does. But yeah, so it's right on the border, right on the Savannah River there. And
yeah.
The main claims to fame that Augusta has are that's where James Brown was born and lived until he passed away.
Yeah.
He lived in Beach Island, South Carolina, which is, again, like right over the bridge. I actually, when I was working for public radio at the time, I covered his funeral. So I went to his funeral at the Civic Center, which is like the local arena.
Wow.
And like Michael Jackson was there.
Sure.
He gave a eulogy.
Like a who's who.
He was surrounded by these like crazy Nation of Islam guys and like little bow ties, you know,
and
the glasses. And it was like seeing a cartoon character walk into a room. You know, it was like seeing Scooby-Doo come to life, walk into a room and give a eulogy for James Brown. It was very, very weird.
Oh, Michael Jackson gave the eulogy?
He gave a eulogy.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember he said
and
something.
And you saw that?
I saw it, yeah.
That's amazing.
And, you know, thousands of my closest friends. I almost didn't get in because even though I was like press, it was so bonkers that I like had
so
to kind of like barely, you know, practically sneak in.
Like, get out of here, kid. You had to have been young.
But I was like in my 20s, I guess. But Michael Jackson did say something very moving. He said, you know, when I was a little boy, I would wake up every morning to watch the master at work. He's talking about watching him dance and stuff. Because, you know, Michael Jackson, everybody ripped off James Brown's dance moves. I mean, he was the guy. He invented that shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
He basically did the moonwalk before the moonwalk was the moonwalk, you know?
Yeah, well, and there are dudes that did the moonwalk. I mean, there's very famous footage, like old black and white footage of supposedly the first moonwalk. I can't remember the guy's name.
His name was Neil Armstrong.
Dad joke.
Yeah, I know. That's me.
It was, I can't remember his name, but, you know, like, you know, not Jelly Roll Morton. But
yeah, it was like
just,
Boots McGee or something.
Yeah,
like that,
some old school dancer from, like, I don't even know what year it was. And he, like, when you see the video, and Josh and I did a whole episode on moonwalking, and he just, it's unmistakable. It's not like, well, it's sort of the moonwalking, but not really. It's full on moonwalk.
It's not like some proto moonwalk. It's like the moonwalk.
Fully formed
moonwalk.
Moonwalk. Yeah. Decades before anyone else.
Do you remember I guess, rumor or the urban legend associated with moonwalk that he had mirrors on his shoes?
Oh, yeah. That was like just a trick.
And how does that even make sense? Like, how would that do anything for you?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense.
No,
it turns out Michael Jackson was just really good at dancing.
Yeah. And the other claim to fame of Augusta is, you know, the Masters golf tournament.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I would go with my friends and we would hang out outside the Masters because my friends lived in this neighborhood called National Hills, which is right across from the National. And we would just wait for rich people to leave in the middle of the day. And we would just kind of be like, please, sir, may we have your practice round tickets? And they would give them to us and we would sell them. And then we'd have a nice steak dinner
Really?
At Lone Star, which was a steak place that was right there.
So they were tickets that had already been used?
Well, you could just pass them off. It was like a full day's ticket.
And oh, okay.
You could just, for the practice rounds.
So they had like extras they would just give them?
No, they were just like, we're leaving for the day. Here you go, kid.
Oh, knock you can yourself get back out. In with that
and
ticket.
You can get back in. So one time,
here you go, kid.
One time we actually went in. And I realized that I don't care for golf and that it was quite boring. But it's a beautiful course. It's nice to just walk around and see all the crazy shit they do. They do really weird horticulture stuff there. Like they will freeze flowers and plants so that they bloom at just the right time.
Yeah.
So it's this like magical
awesome.
Wonderland of like, you know, blooms and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So
that's some Disney World shit.
It's crazy. And I knew people that like worked on the grounds crew and it was like, you know, really, really intense.
Oh,
stuff.
Sure. Yeah. That's not like, there's not a blade out of place.
No.
Well, you know, I live over by the East Lake Golf Club.
Yeah.
The old school. And they just had that tournament this past weekend.
I know. My ex-wife and my daughter live right over there too. And it was super annoying going to pick her up because, you know, Candler Road is just like totally blocked
I used to get into it a little bit and think it was kind of cool just because it's activity in the neighborhood and it's a big national, dare I say, international sports thing happening, you know, 800 yards from my house, not even less than that. And it was kind of cool. But then over the years, like the golf dicks just disrespecting the neighborhood. It's like you always had the sense that they came in from the outer suburbs and were just like, man, fuck this place. Like,
totally.
I can throw my beer can in the yard because it's not perfectly manicured. It's and I'm not a fighter at all, but I confronted a guy a few years ago, these two drunk dicks. One of them threw a cigarette in my yard as he was getting in his car, and I had had it. And I finally went out there and I was like, dude, fucking pick that up. Pick it up.
Yep.
And he should have gone, sorry, man, and picked it up. And he was like, no, fuck you. And I was oh, God. Luckily, if they would have both been that way, I probably would have like gotten my ass kicked.
Mm.
But luckily, his friend did the deal where he was like, I know my friend's being a huge asshole.
He was the good cop.
Let me find it, get it, and get him out of here.
He was the good cock.
So anyway, but Tiger Woods won. It was
I
a big
know.
Deal.
Like,
I heard
a,
the roar from my
right.
house.
People are really excited. He's like, everybody likes a good good redemption story, I guess, right?
Yeah, and then this, of course, in the neighborhood Facebook page, this one guy started going off about supporting a serial adulterer. And I'm like, man, listen, I don't think it's awesome that Tiger Woods cheated
no,
a lot.
Better an adulterer than a
But like, I'm not
rapist.
Married to him.
No,
that's between
know.
He and his wife, ex-wife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you don't support anything, anyone who's ever cheated, then there would be no entertainment industry or sports industrial complex.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
It wouldn't happen.
And they reconciled, right? I mean, he and his wife, or no?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like they get along fine and are parenting their kids.
Oh, but they're not together.
Oh,
No. Okay.
No, not at all. No. He cheated a lot.
Yes. Oh, okay. It was a lot, Yeah. I didn't really follow that.
But I was just like, come on, man.
There was a story about a golf club, like her running after his car and smashing it with a golf club or something.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Who knows?
So we've talked a little bit before in here, and I didn't want to tread too much on it because I knew this day would come, but about your life as a kid.
Yeah.
You're an only, right?
I'm an only. One and only.
Yeah. And then you had parents who were both entertainers.
Yeah. They were both opera singers. My mom was a little bit more successful, a good bit more successful than my dad. She had a contract at the Met in New York for many years, and I would always go hang out with her. And you know,
how did that work? Did she live away for?
She would go away for months at a time. Yeah,
was that tough?
It was. It was just. It was kind of just what I knew. But I do have memories of like being bummed that she was leaving.
Yeah.
But I would also get to go out and visit her. Like I remember going to France and spending a couple weeks with her, and you know, going to New York a lot. And
uh-huh.
Her manager, who is my godmother, who I'm still very close with today, lived in New York, and we lived in Germany. Growing when I was born, lived in Würzburg, Germany, because my dad's career had kind of ended, and he had a job as a choir director guy on a military base.
Wow.
And so she, being based in Europe, was good for her career because there was tons of opera houses around there, and she sang all over. But she'd go to the States plenty as well and sing at the Met. And then we moved to Georgia because he got another job at another church. It's kind of weird. Like, even though she was sort of like doing the best in the family career wise.
Yeah.
She sort of like
followed him,
kowtowed to whatever he wanted to do as well. Yeah. It's kind of the story.
That's that generation. Story of
yeah. Big time.
What, so you were born in Augusta?
I was born in Germany.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was born in Germany.
And lived there until what age?
Lived there until I was six. Like I went to German kindergarten and like we spoke German in the house and stuff. It was wild.
So you have memory of being in Germany?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. I do.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Yeah, I went to this German kindergarten. I remember my teacher's name was Frau Neuhaus.
Uh-huh.
And she, whenever we'd go to the States and come back, she'd always ask me to bring her Butterfinger bars because you couldn't get Butterfingers.
No, it'd be
Germany.
A good boy. Don't be get your
good
Butterfinger.
Be a little German boy and bring me the Butterfingers. Butterfingers.
You know, I took German. That was sort of my jam.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I took German in high school and college.
I did, too.
Traveled to Germany.
And it didn't do fuck all for me, man, because, like, I had at least a first grade-esque grasp of the German language when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to, like, rekindle that. And so I was like, okay, I'll just take German foreign languages. And I can still pick stuff out and if I'm watching a film or if I'm hearing conversation.
Yeah, same
but
here.
I can't rattle it off anymore.
Same here.
I can't do it.
I can get, like... you know, if someone speaks a 15-word sentence, I can get like six of the words.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes enough to be like, you know, all right, I understood the word for danger and fire.
Exactly. That means, you know.
Get out.
Escape. Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, it's also hard because people that are native speakers speak so rapid fire and use so much slang and shorthand.
Oh,
it's hard
for sure.
It's hard to pick it out because you learned like, you know, classically or, I don't know, they always try to build in like the colloquialisms and stuff.
It's better now. Yeah. But when I was in high school, Frau McCullough, my high school German teacher, shout out to Frau McCullough. She was great. She was young. She was one of those like kind of young, crunchy hippie types that like lived in Germany. It's like, hey, I can teach this, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't, it was still like the textbooks were shitty and you kind of had to follow the curriculum somewhat. So there was less like real world conversation than there is probably now.
I remember when I took it, it was pretty built into the curriculum to make sure to teach some of the slang and the way teenagers talk. I remember learning,
right.
Super cool. Das ist super cool.
What did that mean?
That is super cool, Chuck.
Oh, okay.
Super cool.
That's so funny that they would teach you that, like, of all things. It's a cognate that sounds exactly English version.
There's a lot of that.
Have you been back to Germany since as an adult?
I haven't been back to Europe since I was a kid, actually. I get to travel a lot in the States for work and stuff, but I have shamefully not.
You do. That's how you get over being heartsick is you exercise and you fucking go to Europe for like 2 weeks.
Well, tell that to the bosses and they can give me a nice big bonus. And I'll
Yeah, you can afford to go to Europe. Come on.
Okay, we'll see.
Book a ridiculous history show in front of the old Berlin Wall.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I think you should. All right. So grew up in Germany, moved back to the States when you're six-ish.
Yeah.
And back to Augusta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or
and
not
then,
back to Augusta.
Well,
but
no, just to
Augusta.
And then I moved to Birmingham, Alabama when I was mid-high school kind of, or like late high school.
Because mm-hmm.
my dad actually lost his job because he was still carrying that like opera torch. You know, the thing about classical musicians is like a lot of times when the work dries up
mm-hmm.
for being like in an orchestra or being a professional classical musician, you get a job at a church.
Yeah.
You become an organist or you become a choir director or
that's
whatever.
That's where the organs are.
That's where they are. That's where they keep them,
yeah.
at the church. And so, yeah, so he did that. But he was very much into it because he was able to continue doing all this like choral sacred music that he was, you know, a big fan of or
right.
whatever. And the kind of stuff that he had done when he was still a perfect career classical musician, I
guess.
And he also directed a little choral group in Augusta called the Augusta Choral Society.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of got railroaded out of his job at the church because the tides were changing and it was like, you know, got to get the old man out and get some young bucks in to do this more like praise and worship, rock and roll kind of like church stuff.
Right.
So he kind of
how rocking that is.
Oh, it's so rocking. And just the kids, they just love it. It's injecting new blood into the Methodist church. This is just what they needed.
Yeah.
Just like kicking the pants. So he ended up getting a job in Birmingham. So I moved to Birmingham for my junior year.
Of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And finished up there.
No, I actually moved back to Augusta. I had a pretty rough time of it. So I moved back to Augusta when uh, to be to be a senior and actually lived on my own.
So Birmingham didn't take?
It didn't take, no.
And so you emancipated yourself?
I emancipated myself.
Oh, you really did?
No, not really, but I had their blessing to do
that. Okay, but did you have to, like, do any official paperwork for something like that? Or
no.
They didn't care?
No, I didn't care, no.
So who'd you live with your senior year?
I lived with an old friend of, like, in a guest house behind an old friend of our family's who lived next door to where we used to live in our old neighborhood.
But you lived in a guest house by yourself?
My mom actually lived with me, too. My parents weren't really getting along super well at the time, so she kind of looked at it as an opportunity to kind of come get out of that situation for a bit as well.
So. Are they divorced now?
My dad's actually passed away.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen?
It's been about 10 years.
I'm sorry to hear that, man.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he was an interesting guy. Very, very talented, but very troubled.
Yeah.
He was kind of a troubled dude. And
do you think part of that had to do with Kurt not having as much success in the opera world as he wanted?
I think he always felt a bit, in my mom's shadow in terms of the career stuff. But
yeah.
I think he turned that into kind of a resentment or whatever and sort of didn't treat her the best. And so they didn't have the most happy relationship.
That's shitty. Well, join the club, buddy.
Hey, I know. No shit, man. No shit. It is utterly unremarkable.
Well, what is remarkable, sadly, is a friend that you have that has two parents that are still together and still very much in love.
Yeah.
And like.
Yeah.
Like that is the exception.
Yeah, no, it's tough. I'm in an interesting situation myself because I am divorced, but my ex and I are very, very close, and we have a daughter together, and we do stuff together, and we're, like, super chill.
Yeah.
I was really young when we had our daughter, and it just kind of went through the motions and did the stuff you thought you were supposed to do.
Right.
As far as, like, being a strong man or whatever and doing the right thing by your kid and everything. So we got married and bought a house and it just wasn't right. And now we've kind of realized that and realized that we're better as co-parents and friends and stuff. So
that's good that you can do that. That's my parents didn't have a good post-marriage. They were just the couple that like, all right, well, I guess we're never going to talk again.
Really?
Kind of thing.
Yeah, I hate to hear that.
For the most part.
But it seems like that's a more common situation, and I'm pretty lucky because it could be that way, and that would make having the kid together way more difficult. But instead, we're like, it's almost like we're brother and sister these days. We're like really, really pretty close and help each other out. And
that's great.
Yeah.
I love hearing that. It's good, people should get divorced,
No shit. My parents should have gotten divorced.
My parents should have gotten divorced. They did get divorced when I was 18. They probably should have gotten divorced when I was like 10.
Yeah.
Looking back.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's not go down that road.
No, we've already been down some roads, my friend.
Let's talk about movies.
I like movies.
What, growing up then as an only child, sort of moving around, sort of feeling out of sorts in different cities, my guess is that you probably found comfort in movies and TV.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was like a really, really nice escape. And I was super into, I really came into it probably in the early 2000s or the late 90s when I really started getting into like what I thought of as like interesting stuff.
Uh-huh.
There was a nice little, not resurgence, but a nice crop of cool filmmakers right around that time. Like Fincher was first coming out with stuff.
Yeah.
And Fight Club and,
So how old were you when Fight Club came out?
I don't know.
Were you in high school?
I was in high school, yeah.
Yeah, that's so weird to me.
And I loved it. I loved all that stuff. And I loved all the Michel Gondry stuff, Eternal Sunshine, and, all of those director's series DVD sets that, with like Gondry and Spike Jones and all those. I loved music
Criterion
videos.
And stuff.
Well, it wasn't Criterion. It was just called the director's series where it was like there was one for Chris Cunningham who did all the Aphex Twin videos. And then there was one for
a DVD compilation.
It was a DVD compilation of all
work.
Their work.
Yeah.
And then like the Michel Gondry one had all the crazy White Stripes videos that he did. And I think that's what really started getting me into film was some of those really cool, like more experimental out there kind of like visually stunning music videos. And so I kind of glommed on to some of those directors. And then through them, I found other interesting stuff as well. Kind of the same way I did with music, because my parents weren't really into film or music. They were artists, they were musicians, but that was like work for them.
Right.
So like they didn't listen to cool records or really have good taste in movies. They didn't really, it wasn't something they did for fun. So I kind of had to find my own way.
And so you didn't have the older sibling to usher that culture in either.
So there's a lot of cross-referencing where like I was really into the Smashing Pumpkins, for example.
Sure.
And because of that, I got into stuff like Joy Division and My Bloody Valentine and, you know, New Order and all of these bands that were connected to them through people they'd worked with and influences they'd had. Same with the film stuff.
Now, you played – I know you are a musician from like early on with not clarinet, violin.
I was violin, yeah.
When did you start playing – you know, rock and roll.
Rock and roll. I mean, I kind of taught myself how to play guitar at a pretty young age. Like I would say, you know, fifth, sixth grade, I started messing with guitar.
Yeah, same here.
And because I was like, you know, had been playing violin since I was six, I kind of had a pretty good ear and I was able to just sort of like pick stuff out and you know, dick my way around learning some songs. And
you could sing, obviously.
I could sing, and I'd always like play for my parents' little dinner parties. I was so embarrassing. Like they had a little, like a little salon kind of where my mom was a singing teacher as well. And so was my dad. And they had like a little raised area in this like big living room with a piano and all these couches. And they'd have like all their, you know, artsy friends over. And I would play like Smashing Pumpkins covers and stuff. You know?
Oh, on the guitar?
Uh-huh, on the guitar.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see a picture of
talent
that.
Talent shows. I was little in
young 13-year-old bearded and all.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't bearded yet. The beard didn't come till about 13.
Yeah.
And then it stuck around. But no, I was crazy. I was actually in a band with these dudes that I met in my church where my dad worked in the youth group. And one of them
youth group band.
Yeah, it was youth group band. I remember we would play Hootie and the Blowfish songs.
Yeah.
And we would play Big Me by the Foo Fighters and Zombie by the Cranberries.
Oh, sure.
All that kind of stuff. And one of the dudes is now in that band Lady Antebellum. Have you heard of Lady A?
Yeah, I've heard of them.
They're like
Are they country?
They're mega pop crossover country smash hit guys. And
yeah.
It was funny because there's a picture I'll show you sometime where it's like all these like total like visor type button down plaid like bro dudes standing behind me, and I'm sitting in the front wearing a Smashing Pumpkin shirt, black fingernail polish on, shoulder length black hair, and just looking like demure as fuck.
Right.
And like needless to say, that musical partnership did not last. And they went on to more Garth Brooksy terrain.
Right. But I imagine pretty soon you hooked up with people of like mind.
Yeah, yeah. I played in a bunch of different bands. I played like drums in a punk band for a while. I played guitar in another kind of more like Sonic Youth-y type band. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up doing my own thing I was in like kind of a new metal-y type band for a while when I was in like my late teens or mid-teens, I guess, where I was the singer and I sort of like screamed and even rapped a little bit.
It's like, all coming out.
I was really into like Incubus and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty humiliating.
No, it's not.
It is what it is.
That's all like the DNA of Noel. That's great.
It's life stuff.
I love it. I mean, my very first guitar was a Candy Apple Red BC Rich.
Oh, hell yeah.
Like metal special.
That's awesome.
And I, you know, that's because like Eddie Van Halen was my favorite guitar player.
I had a Sparkle Blue Ibanez.
Ooh.
With the whammy
Floyd
bar.
Rose tremolo.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Stuff. Oh, man, the Floyd Rose. I thought, like, that was the end-all be-all.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't afford that.
Well, it was cool because it was so, like, the strings are locked in, so you could take that whammy bar and shove it all the way down so the strings would just totally go loose and then, like, go...
That's Eddie Van Halen.
A lot of fun.
It's funny when you're talking about the early directors that you were into and the music videos and stuff, like, that became a legit path to filmmaking.
Oh, totally.
To making movies was, and of course we're going to talk about adaptation, but Spike Jonze and Gondry, like they made these groundbreaking music videos.
Oh, for sure.
That were just, it was film school, it was training ground.
Well, and it was like some of the early ones too, like were super practical effects based.
Yeah.
And it was like all these tricks that they kind of like figured out for themselves that they were then able to like use in their, you know, movies when they actually had a little bit more of a budget.
Yeah.
But like that, there's that Spike Jonze video for that Wax song, California, you know, where it's just this dude on fire, like running down the street in slow motion.
Yeah.
It's all just one shot.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, you know, I mean, sure, it's not like cheap to set a guy on fire, but it's also like just such a stunning, simple trick that like keeps you captivated. And then like the camera pans out and you realize it's this girl watching through the window and in this car, and that's the whole video. And it was like just these little conceits like that, these little simple ideas that then they were able to kind of like turn into much bigger ideas when they got, you know, movie money.
Yeah. And Spike, like he especially was, I mean, he made stuff before the Buddy Holly video, but that's the one that really sort of put him on the map.
Yeah, I mean, I think he actually got to start making like skate videos. Like, I think he was like a young like skater kid in LA, and
he was a skate photographer,
right?
And then like, made like, you know, the, I don't know the terminology, but the, you know, the hardcore videos.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Bones Brigade.
Bones Brigade.
Yeah.
That's right. And then he moved into music video, and you know, I mean, he was a rich kid,
right? I mean,
he was Adam Spiegel of the Spiegel family fortune,
right? And there's a connection with him and the Coppolas and stuff too, or did I make that up? Is that just
well, he married Sophia?
That's right.
That was the connection.
But they split up, though.
Yeah, they got divorced. Yeah. And in fact, the character, the Giovanni Ribisi character in Lost in Translation, is highly influenced by Spike Jonze.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Sort of obnoxious.
I could see that. I could see him being a little full of himself. But God, he's brilliant.
Yeah, sure.
And you know what's funny? He actually made a video recently that was kind of like a callback. Like, he doesn't really – nobody – it's so weird. Music videos, like the cachet of music videos is sort of like not what it used to be, you know?
Where I mean, they still make them, right?
They definitely still make them, but it's like you got to like look, seek them out and find them on YouTube or whatever. There's like obviously MTV's not like churning out blocks of time with music videos anymore. But he made a video. It was actually a Apple commercial, an iTunes commercial with this artist FKA Twigs, and I forget, she wasn't the singer, but she's in the video. She's like this amazing kind of weirdo, sort of almost like a soul Bjork kind of, but she's also an amazing trained dancer. And in the video, it's like her in her apartment, like listening to music, and then all of a sudden, like she starts like moving the walls around, and everything starts like fanning out, and like, you know, she pushes a panel on the wall, and like the wall kind of like goes inward, and like everything, like there's posters on the wall, and the posters start like splitting up into like little segmented, kind of like as though you were taking something and stretching it out, you know, really, really amazing practical type effects.
Yeah.
And it's just, it really reminded me of why I loved that early stuff.
And well, he did the It's Oh So Quiet video, that great Bjork video.
Which is just all choreography and all just like perfect timing with
the
camera moves. And
it was the heyday. It was, that's when actually Emily was a music video producer. And during that heyday, when you could get like a fucking $1 million to direct a music video.
Right.
Budget wise.
Yeah.
For the biggest of the big. But it was a little playground for people like Spike Jonze.
Yep.
Like they would get sought out and hired, or Hype Williams, and they would just throw money at him and say, what do you want to do? And you could be as creative as you wanted to be. And that's why Spike did things like the Buddy Holly video, or it's like these, you know, really ambitious,
creative
things.
And I take it back what I was saying a minute ago, how it's like, you know, these were all simple, practical videos. Like, no, like these were like massive. Some of these were like Busby Berkeley, you know, camera panning through the ceiling, kind of like huge productions or whatever, like the Berk video. But I guess what I was getting at more is like, you know, there's one of my favorites is, I believe it was Michelle Gondry, because I kind of lumped them together. They were sort of active at the same time.
Yeah.
They had a similar sensibility, you know.
They would live in the same house.
Yeah,
if, you know?
Exactly. What do you say, Chuck? Park their cars in the same garage?
Exactly.
Yeah. There's a video for the White Stripes song Dead Leaves on the Dirty Ground where it's just like, it's like he's like in this house and there's projections on the wall of like other stuff that has happened in this house that's sort of like meant to be stand-ins for memories he's had about, you know, bad shit that went down in this house or like something with a love lost or whatever. But it's such a simple device and it's very clearly like a practical thing where they're shooting projections on the wall in the room and then filming it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that stuff just really did it for me.
Yeah, it's cool. It's, I mean, sadly, those days are gone. I know they still make music videos, but like Emily worked, she saw that transition happen from we have all the money in the world to do what we want to 3 years later, we have a job that would have been a $600,000 job 5 years ago. And now here's $100,000 and we want the same thing. So the expectation was the same, but the money wasn't.
The closest thing I can compare these days to that is this director team. They go by the name Daniels, and they made that movie Swiss Army Man with
I didn't see that. Paul Dano?
Oh, it's great. It's really fucking weird. It's like, you know.
Is that the farty one?
It's the farting corpse one where Paul Dano's like marooned on this island or whatever, and Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter himself, is this like bloated farting corpse that he finds, and he ends up like riding him around like a dog. And it's all this like, but these guys made music videos. Like they made like the Turn Down for What video.
I don't know that.
It's a kind of a big club song, but it's like this dude that's just everyone's like twerking, you know, doing that crazy twerk dance, but they keep twerking through like the floor and like down through into like other floors in this building.
Yeah.
So it's very much the same sensibilities as some of those videos from the early aughts and the late 90s.
I love that. It's just like creativity unhinged.
Yeah.
Because you've got 3 or 4 minutes to make a statement.
Yeah. Well, and now, and like with digital and stuff, and like the way the kind of democratization of creativity with like, you know, iMovie and whatever,
yeah, which
and like
is great.
All of these tools, you got like a lot of like opportunity for like younger directors and artists to like make really compelling, cool shit, even just using like an iPhone or something.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat.
There are iPhone movies out now.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Did you ever see the IKEA lamp spot that Spike Jonze did?
No.
With the lamp that was thrown away?
Uh-uh. Sounds sad. Is it heartbreaking?
It's like, it's literally a 60-second IKEA spot that like makes you want to cry because this guy got rid of his lamp and got a new lamp. And it's like all from the perspective of this lamp. Like he gives this lamp a life and emotion. And then it's down on the street looking up in his house at the new lamp on the desk. And it's really so sad. You got to check it out. I'll send it to you.
Cool.
All right, well, let's talk about adaptation.
Let's do it.
Well, let me tell you real quick, my first experience with this movie was my friend Stacy is a costume designer on very big movies, the biggest Hollywood movies. And she lived in L.A., still lives in L.A., although she's in Atlanta right now, of course, because Atlanta is L.A.
Yeah. What do they call it, Yollywood?
Yollywood.
Yeah.
But she... She used to give me scripts just because when I was first started writing, it was like just read. Like read professional movie scripts was...
Yeah, I mean, even just to like get the formatting down and like how do you write stage direction and whatever.
All of it, man. Yeah, it's just all like that's the best way to learn. If you're out there and you want to write scripts, read scripts, a lot of them. So she would give me scripts. She gave me a script one day on a movie that she was in pre-pro on called The Orchid Thief.
Yes.
And I, written by a guy named Charlie Kaufman, never heard of him.
Ugh.
And I read it, and I had read, I'd probably read about at least a dozen other scripts at this point. So I kind of knew, you know, my way around a script. And I gave it back to her, and I was like, Stacy, I was like, I've never read anything like that in my life. And I was like, I can't believe they're going to make this movie. I was like, are you sure? She was like, no, we're in pre-pro right now. It's like fucking Meryl Streep's in it. And of course, it changed the name to Adaptation.
Yeah, yeah.
But it literally, figuratively, blew my mind.
Well, this is going to be a fun talk then, Chuck, because obviously this is a movie about screenwriting.
Yeah.
And about adapting unadaptable shit,
yeah.
You know, and like the idea that Hollywood is so thirsty to take any potential bestseller and make it into a fucking movie. Like apparently they bought the rights to this book, The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean, which is about this guy, John LaRoche, who is an orchid poacher, I guess, or orchid hunter, looking for this very special orchid, the ghost orchid.
Right.
And they bought the rights before it had even been adapted into a book. It was a New Yorker piece.
Yeah.
And that's what's featured in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
When she's the character played by Meryl Streep is like going through her interviews with this guy, John LaRoche, this kind of kooky backwoods Florida, you know, outdoorsman type.
Yeah.
So that's when she's writing the piece for The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And then it gets adapted into a book. But the whole thing about the movie is it's like Charlie Kaufman, who is played by Nicolas Cage, is trying, he's been assigned this job to adapt this book.
Sort of this impossible adaptation.
Right. And it's a book about adaptation, like as in like biological adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
Because the
so
orchids.
So many layers.
Oh, my God. Don't even. So I'm sorry, Chuck. I didn't want to derail you. Please continue.
No, that's it. I had never read anything like it. I was just like, you can, and it's easy now because adaptation has been made and everyone's seen it and it's easy to take for granted a little bit. But at the time, I was just like, I've never read anything like this.
And were you like, what does this look like? How is this movie?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. And the backstory there, of course, is Charlie Kaufman was hired to adapt this thing.
Weirdly off of the success of Being John Malkovich, another Spike Jonze film.
Well, sure, which we should talk about for a second.
Yeah.
Because that movie blew me away. And it was their first pairing, and I was like, man, this is – shit is getting interesting in Hollywood right now.
Right. That's my ripe young time when like my mind was lighting up with all of this like creativity and this weird shit.
Yeah.
You know, like I was so excited about movies like that.
And then, and I think what got me with Being John Malkovich too was it had all the DNA of like a studenty college student filmmaker idea. It's like, oh, it's fucked up, man. Let's do this movie where, like, you're fucking in John Malkovich's head.
What?
Like, literally. And then there are all these Malkoviches. But he did that on a major Hollywood scale, and it worked.
And it's moving. It's funny. It's, like, heartbreaking. It's, like, all the things. And so is adaptation.
Yeah.
I would argue more so. Like, I think it even takes it a step further.
Oh, Charlie Kaufman can nail, like, pathos.
Yeah. Yeah,
like
no,
nobody's
it's,
business.
It's out of control. So he's hired to adapt, which is so weird. Like, why? Why would you, like, and why would he accept it? Because I think the way it's portrayed in the movie, it's like he wanted to do something different, and then he realized that he could only really do the thing that he does. Like, he wanted to, like, prove to himself that he could just do a straight adaptation and make more of a – like, he keeps talking to – because he's got a brother, a twin brother in the movie, played also by Nicolas Cage, Donald, right?
Yeah.
And he – Donald represents, like, the hack side of Hollywood, right?
Oh, yeah.
And Charlie represents sort of the you know,
integrity.
The artist, the integrity or whatever. And Charlie is constantly
two sides of himself. Quite literally.
Oh, I think so. And I mean, and obviously Donald does not exist. Charlie does not have in real life.
Although he gets a fake screenwriting credit, which is great.
I know, it's genius. But so it's like he's constantly browbeating his brother who has just moved into his house. Charlie, by the way, is like super depressed and despondent and doesn't know
where his
life is going. He thinks he's fat. He's like, he's got this inner monologue that's constantly buzzing around, like, oh,
so
fat, stupid. It's like, maybe I'll write a little bit. Oh, maybe I'll get a coffee. No, I'm going to write first, then get a coffee.
Yeah.
Maybe a muffin.
All that stuff, though, is so effective at, like, not only setting this character, but the tone and the mood of the movie, which so much of it is to, I think, make you feel anxious and somewhat upset as a viewer.
And then and then Donald, who is just kind of a adult.
I love Donald.
Oh, he's great because he's so upbeat.
You can't help but love him.
He's like, what's the matter, bro?
Such a sweet guy.
Yeah, but exactly.
He's never a dick.
He's not a dick, but Charlie feels like he's a dick, or he resents him so much.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, and Charlie's the dick.
Charlie
and
is
he treats
the dick.
Donald like an asshole,
exactly.
But Donald never takes the bait. He's always just like,
I know, bro. That's a good point, man. Yeah.
It's so sweet.
Totally.
It's great. And never for a moment do you – I mean, I've seen this movie a lot of times, and I never think for a second that that's not two different people. Like, it just hit me last night. I was like, that's Nicolas Cage playing both parts. I know that sounds weird, but they exist so fully as independent characters from their posture, like, to everything. He fucking nailed it.
I mean, that's the thing about Nicolas Cage is, like, he's like a deadly fucking weapon. Like, in the right hands, he can, like, you know, he could take out a dictator or something like that. In the wrong hands, he could murder a school full of children or something like that.
I kind of like his whole thing now, though, which is, like, I have a lifestyle where I spend a lot of money. He very notoriously, or not notorious, but famously is a spender.
Yeah, he likes to, he had like a T-Rex skull, and he had like a crazy murder mansion in New Orleans. And a lot of it got repoed, I think, because he just couldn't keep his shit together.
So now he's just like, I'll be in anything.
Yeah.
And occasionally he'll do a great movie.
Yeah, like Mandy, by the way. Have you seen Mandy?
No, I still haven't seen it.
Oh, God, it's so great. Yeah. I got it on, I bought it on Amazon. I'll let you borrow it.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Is that a thing? Can you do that? Is that legal?
Maybe. Just give me your laptop.
There you go. No, it's great. But that's the thing about Nick Cage, though. It's like that's the best way I can put it. He's like an atomic bomb. Like in the right hands, he could do good.
Yeah.
In the wrong hands, he just fucking chews up the scenery and blows everything all to hell, you know?
Yeah. And he always has made such weird choices as an actor, not like for the role, but once he has the role, like acting choices, from the weird voice in Peggy Sue Got Married, like he's always known for, I think he's a true artist. As much schlocky crap as he's in, he's never uninteresting.
Oh no, no. And he commits, he makes choices.
Yeah.
And I think I read somewhere that in this movie, an adaptation, he is less just unhinged Cage and like less just doing his own thing and like shooting for the rafters than he is really, really solidly taking direction from Jones. And I can see that. It's a very restrained performance on both counts, you know?
Yeah.
Like he doesn't do a whole lot of typical Nick Cage like scenery chewing.
No. He fully inhabits these dudes.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, he's so talented.
The part's so internal too. Like Charlie, it's all inner monologue, like you were saying. There isn't a lot of outward, although, you know, as the movie starts to, and one thing I love about it is it starts to build momentum and spin out of control and get more frenetic, and it just has such the pacing of this movie is just so genius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pacing and just the way it sort of folds back on itself at some point. We'll get there. But
amazing.
Yeah, so that's kind of the setup. Where do you want to go next?
Yeah, well, so Charlie Kaufman is hired in real life to adapt this thing. Very famously, he had a lot of stress and anxiety, couldn't do it. This is after his early career was, I don't know if you know this, but he was like a sitcom guy. He wrote on Ned and Stacey.
That's right.
And Get a Life.
Yeah. And, I didn't know that.
Here, the Dana Carvey Show.
That's right. Yep. I remember the Dana Carvey Show.
Yeah. I mean, he was just this sort of sitcom staff writer.
Uh-huh.
Then comes up with something like Being John Malkovich, which is just bonkers.
Yeah.
That leads him, obviously, to like, whoa, who the fuck is this guy? Let's hire him to do The Orchid Thief.
Well, not to mention that movie did well. And that's true because it was like that was his first big feature and it did well and it was so crazy. I still think it's such an odd choice knowing what that movie is to get him to adapt such a kind of straightforward, almost like what should have been like a Nat Geo documentary about.
I don't even know what that movie would have been.
Yeah, well, he didn't either.
You know?
I mean, it's unwritable, I think, is sort of the whole point of this movie.
Yeah, like what would it have been? Because it's not, he made up the whole love story or between LaRoche and Susan Orlean. Like that didn't happen in real life.
No.
He created all this stuff and got writer's block to the point where he started, and he didn't pitch this. He said that he knew that if he pitched, like he had this new idea of how to tackle it, this bonkers bananas idea, and knew if I go to them, there's no way they're going to fucking let me do this. So he's like, I knew I had to write it. And he wrote the full script without telling anybody but Spike Jonze what he was doing, brought it to the studio, and by some miracle, they were like, this is amazing. Instead of saying like, what is this?
Yeah. Well, there's those early meetings that he has in the movie with the producer from, I think it's Columbia Pictures, that's Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
And her body language is so intense where she's just like, he's kind of like frenetically trying to explain to her how he wants to tackle this differently and how it's like, it's simple. It's about beauty. It's about, you know, whatever. And she's just kind of like really uneasy and sort of like, okay, Charlie, but where's the, give me the pages. We need the pages.
Yeah.
You know?
God, that scene is so uncomfortable.
Yeah. And then he's got this manager who's played by that dude from Office Space.
Ron Livingston.
Who's just like, I'd fuck her in the ass or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's
so great. Yeah,
he's just such a douche bro Hollywood manager.
And like
guy.
One of the great douchey, like agent Hollywood guy characters of all time.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah.
And portrays him as a buffoon too, which
yes.
That's obviously Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman are taking just shots at Hollywood all
of
over
course,
the place.
Of course.
It's great. As they should. So you've got the Kaufman brothers, who, like we said, there is no Donald in real life. And as the movie progresses, Charlie is so beautifully mirror one another, or not mirror, but I guess whatever an opposite mirror is called, as Charlie slides down into the pit of despair.
Yeah.
Donald is writing the three.
Well, he wants to be a screenwriter like his bro, like his big bro, you know?
Yeah.
And so he takes these screenwriting courses from this real guy.
Yeah, named, Robert McKee.
Robert McKee, uh-huh. Played brilliantly, as always, by Brian Cox.
Yeah, who was a recommendation from the real Robert McKee.
That's right.
He was like, you need to get Brian Cox to play me.
And it's funny because I always confuse Brian Cox and Albert Finney.
Oh.
Because they kind of look similar.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was reading in a list of potential casting for McKee.
Uh-huh.
Finney was on the list. So I bet they were up for a lot of the same roles.
Probably
because
so.
They're of a similar age, of a similar nationality.
Finney's great.
Yeah, exactly.
Big fan.
But so Cox got the job. And so McKee is like this, you know, classic Hollywood kind of like screenwriting class teacher guy.
Yeah.
You know,
screenwriting 101.
And it's one of these things where it's like everyone goes to Hollywood. You take these acting classes, you take method, you do these workshops.
Yeah.
And, you know, you use it as like a networking thing, right? But then the people that are teaching these classes, I guess, are like cleaning up and, you know, it's like you're capitalizing on people's dreams and 90% of them are probably talentless acts that are never going to go anywhere. And then there's the ones who maybe already have the talent, and it's like, do they even need a class like that? I don't know.
Right.
Like, can you teach this kind of talent? Like, I don't know. Like, it's what you were saying earlier.
I struggle with that because I have taken courses and classes and have been to the odd seminar here and there. And the question I always have, especially for writing classes, is like, well, you know, why aren't you writing movies then? Which is not cool, probably, to say. Like, if you know what you're doing and you can teach this, then why are you teaching this? Like, why aren't you writing movies?
Well, it's that old cliche thing is like those who can do and those who can't teach. But I think that's not entirely
that's
fair.
Such a slag, yeah.
I think it is too.
Because my parents were teachers and your parents taught, you know, music and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in this situation in particular, though, it's like, people are taking these classes thinking it's going to be their like inroad to fame or whatever.
Right.
And so Kaufman's character, he thinks this guy's a total hack. He is just Charlie is full against this McKee guy.
Uh-huh.
And when his brother Donald says, "So, have you heard of this guy, Robert McKee?"
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, just goes on this tear about how it's just like, you know, such a waste of time, such a waste of money. And then of course,
what happens?
He learns enough about the cliche structure of writing that he writes this like kind of hack job horror screenplay.
The three.
And it was like,
I love it when he's describing it.
Yeah.
Isn't that fucked up, bro?
It's so fucked up. Because it's like the killer and the victim are the same person. And then Donald's, Charlie's like, but how are you going to show them in the same room together?
I know. Which is funny because they're showing them in the same room. Yeah. Like, this whole movie I hate calling it a meta film, but it is. Like, all it does is fold back in on itself, like you were saying, over and over and over.
And it has all these incredible parallels that it takes a minute to even put together because you realize that the groundwork's been laid really early on for stuff that connects back later and it becomes all the more meaningful. Like, so for example, just to move ahead a little bit, Donald's movie gets like optioned for like a shitload of money.
Oh yeah, Ron Livingston, the agent's like, man, your brother's script is really good.
It's really good.
It's tight.
And the three, have you heard this thing, the three?
Oh, God.
And he's just, you know, he's already spiraling out into depression and anxiety.
Oh yeah.
And this is just obviously adding to it.
It's a sledgehammer.
Feeding it. And Donald tells him, man, we've already got a song idea, and it's Happy Together by the Turtles. You know, imagine me and you, I do.
Yeah, and, which they end up using later.
But it's heartbreaking the way they use it because you realize like they're the ones like they become like the detective twins when the story starts to like kind of go off the rails because Charlie is so fucked up about this project. He doesn't know what to do. So he decides he's got to go talk to Susan herself, Meryl Streep's character,
which
in New
he
York.
Can't do though.
He's so crippled by his anxiety and his stress. So he gets Donald to do it for him.
Uh-huh.
And then Donald goes and interviews her, and he's such a goofball.
Really nice.
She's so nice, bro, but I don't think she's quite telling the truth, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole story just takes a crazy turn, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are two storylines going on. You've got Charlie and Donald and the writing of this script, and then you have in the past, I think a few years before, it's telling these—
The New Yorker
yeah,
piece.
You have the Susan Orlean story.
And LaRoche.
Yeah, and it's they converge in like the most brilliant way, how it all finally comes together. And you know, we're not finishing up here, but that third act, you know, it's just bonkers. It all just goes— it's like, I remember when I read that script and it got to the third act when they're getting this drug from the ghost orchid, and she's having this affair and she's addicted to drugs, and the end with the big chase scene and shooting at one another and the alligator. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? What is going on?
It's all of the stuff that Charlie was super against.
Yeah.
And then he realized that, like, He couldn't make this adaptation, this script, without resorting to some of these like cliche devices that he like hated.
He even says there's that one great part about, you know, with the car chases and the guy that learns something in the end, and like and then all those things happen in real life.
Yeah,
and
exactly. Yeah. No, so brilliant. Yeah. So no, I don't want to jump the gun too much, but maybe we should go back to LaRoche a little bit, where he is such an incredible character in this movie.
Well, Chris Cooper.
Oh my god.
I love Chris Cooper, but he's never been better to me than in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, he just embodies this role. He's like—
embodies.
They CGI'd out like his front teeth. He's got this like, you know, just conspicuously missing front teeth.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't know quite why he never got it fixed, or Susan asks him and he doesn't tell her right away.
Yeah.
Tragic. And that comes up in one of the most shocking kind of like shock to the system kind of scenes. Uh-huh. This car crash with his mother, where it's like the perspective is like through the window.
The car
hits like head on, and it's just so jarring.
Out of nowhere, backing out of the driveway, and there's been a lot of movies that have done— it's sort of a trope now where, you know, the everything's going great, and then the car gets T-boned or whatever. But this one truly like caught me off guard.
Oh yeah,
one of the best ones I've seen.
Yeah, and then afterwards it's got him just like wailing about his mother who's died, his front teeth are knocked out, and he's all bloody.
Wife's in a coma.
That's right.
And then she comes out. She comes out of the coma and leaves him.
That's right.
And he's left. And then Hurricane Andrew wipes out his greenhouse and his farm.
Did I make up the thing about his mother? Is that she's—
No.
She's there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it killed everyone except him and his wife. She was in a coma. She leaves him.
Yep.
And the hurricane wipes out his livelihood.
And he loses everything.
And he's just fucking a wreck of a man.
But he is, but he's also not. He's this crazy, compelling dude because he takes on these, like, obsessions, right? Where he talks about how, like, he's got the biggest collection of Dutch mirrors in the world.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he's so confident when he's talking to Orlean, and, like, just, like, he kind of, like—
he's everything she's not.
He's everything she's not because he's, like, legit. He's not a big New York phony.
He's authentic,
and he owns his tragedy, and he owns his shit. He didn't get his teeth replaced because he wanted it to remind him, you know?
Yeah, and she's so, like, enthralled.
Right.
And it draws such a dichotomy between that sort of hoity-toity dinner party that they're having with all the New Yorker elites or whatever.
And they're sort of ragging
on him.
David O.
Russell is one
of those,
right, by the way.
And I think Charlie Kaufman is in that scene or somewhere. He appears in the movie somewhere.
Oh, really?
I can't remember. But, yeah, they're kind of like, you know—
Curtis Hanson's in it.
That's right.
R.I.P.
Yeah. Oh, man. And they're like kind of, you know, thumbing their noses at this guy like he's some sort of backwater kind of redneck dude. And she's sort of playing along just for the sake of you know, keeping up appearances. But you can tell. She leaves the room and like starts crying, or like leaves the room and just kind of has this like intense look on her face or whatever.
Well, I mean, she's got this secret, which is she has a secret, which is— she's sort of falling for this guy who is the complete opposite of her, which is why she's attracted to him, because he is authentic. He does own his tragedies. He owns his passions, like that great scene when he's talking about— he's just so frank about everything. Like, there's no subterfuge.
No.
And she doesn't understand that world.
She doesn't get it. She can't quite—
But when he's talking about the porn— I think I'm going to start doing porn.
Doing porn. Well, that's another one.
Like, so he makes so much money doing porn.
And this is also like in the early days of like, you know, the internet or when the story was set or whatever. And he gets the thing. He like takes on these projects and then he just ditches them, you know? Like, so he was doing fish. He was like tropical fish for a while. And then he goes, fuck fish, you know?
Well,
and then
you want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
That line has become a trope in our household. So he says he was way into fish. He tells his whole story. Then after that happens, and he's trying to illustrate how he can be so into something and leave it alone forever. And he said, you know, fuck fish forever.
Yeah.
And he never looked at a fish again or never had another fish.
Never set one toe in that ocean, as he says, you know.
And that's how much fuck fish. And so that's become a line in our house. Anytime Emily and I, since 2002, are like, you know, screw that thing, whatever, we always say fuck fish.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the line in our house is fuck fish.
Yeah, that's how much fuck fish.
That's how much fuck
fish.
That's
great. That's great.
Such a great line.
Yeah, but that's the thing about this character, too. It's like, so up until the third act that we keep hinting at, and we'll dig into it in just a sec and get there, there's not a whole lot of, like, artifice or, like, a lot of, like, kind of goofy Spike Jonze, like, you know, surrealness in the relationship between LaRoche and Orlean.
Yeah.
It's just very real and very like acted just pitch perfectly. And there's nothing over the top about it at all.
Yeah.
It's
very straightforward.
Very matter of fact. Uh-huh. Right. And the stuff between Charlie and Donald is a little more silly and over the top, their relationship. But in that parallel story, it feels just like they're in the swamp. He's got these like seminal dudes that are helping him. That's what allows him to poach the orchids because
it's their native
seminal
land.
Swamp land. And so when the ranger comes and says, "You're not allowed to do that," he says, "I beg to differ. These men here are full blooded Seminole." And they're like, "Okay, well, I guess we'll be on your way."
Yeah.
But all of that is just played so straight. And it really makes it hit home when the movie kind of turns on its head in that third act. Like, it's just so jarring. But then you realize, like, oh, I'm seeing the script. I'm seeing what's been percolating this whole time.
It's kind of hard to describe even now.
It really is.
How, like, brilliantly it folds in on itself.
Yeah. And it's you know, we say that, oh, now we've seen it and it's out there, but there's still never been anything quite like it.
Yeah.
Like this.
Totally,
like,
agree.
You saw it when you read the script, and then when you saw the movie, I'm sure you were
I could not
amazed.
Wait, man.
I'm sure you were
I was
amazed.
Like, I don't know what I'm going to see after reading that script. I was like, surely they're going to like tweak this thing. But it was all there, you know, like it was all in the script.
Yeah.
So, all right, you got this Orlean LaRoche storyline going on. Then back over to the other, you've got Charlie eventually, like we said, goes to Robert McKee, his story seminar, and one of the great scenes of the movie. God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you.
And that's after he's like, you're hearing his internal monologue just ruminating and talking, like he's been
doing
the whole
voiceover.
Movie. It's all been voiceover, but he also, like, McKee's interjection totally interrupts the stream of consciousness voiceover. And then later he also says, like, and don't cheat if at your ending, you know, don't you dare use a deus ex machina. and here's the thing, like, I want to run this by you. So I read, and this totally makes sense, because let's go ahead and get there. So you mentioned that Orlean and
LaRoche
have this secret love affair, and they're secretly getting high on orchid sauce or whatever, or like orchid dust.
Orchid dust.
Yeah, and it, like, you know, there's an amazing scene where they're both high on this stuff and they're on the phone with each other.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of meant to seem sort of like a hallucinogen, like a mushrooms or some kind of thing that makes you in tune with your surroundings or with nature or with your inner self or whatever.
Yeah.
And they do this like, touch tone thing on the phone or whatever. Uh-huh. And it's really delightful. And like, she's like wiggling her toes and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But that's even before the movie really takes the turn, because when she realizes that Charlie knows about their love affair, he ends up like following them to the swamp and seeing them do the drugs and them like having sex in this crazy, you know, swamp shack or whatever.
Yeah. Then it becomes a thriller.
And then all of a sudden it becomes a thriller where they're chasing them through the swamp.
Uh-huh.
And there's a car crash. And LaRoche is about to shoot Charlie.
Yeah. Well, Donald dies.
Donald dies in the car crash.
Which is the fucking saddest part of the movie.
And they have like this, you know, in Charlie cradling him in his arms.
Yeah.
And then as he's dying, he's singing to him, imagine me and you. I do.
So great.
Now I think about you, Dave.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. But anyway, so LaRoche is about to shoot Charlie, and then fucking this alligator just comes up out of nowhere and eats him and then rolls away.
Which is ridiculous, and that's why it's in there.
But that's the deus ex machina.
Uh-huh.
So that's the thing. But I also thought that McKee himself is kind of the deus ex machina.
Oh, interesting.
Because he is like giving all this information to Charlie that's helping him solve this problem. Like he is coming out of not out of nowhere. He's been alluded to, but the idea of a deus ex machina is that it's a character or a force that isn't really previously referenced very much. It doesn't play like a huge part.
Right.
And then sort of swoops in and makes some big change.
Right.
So I always kind of thought that in terms of Charlie, McKee was sort of his deus ex machina. And telling him, don't use a deus ex machina, because he's the one that kind of like gave him the stuff he needed to like solve the problem or get out of, you know, the jam he was in. But I don't know. That's just me. This isn't something I've always kind of thought about.
No,
but
for sure, man. I see that. And it's so self-referential. Like, of course it is.
Yeah.
I bet you, like, you're totally right on the money. I mean, Kaufman, when he was writing this in real life, he had to have been feeling, and I'm sure it's right there on the page, he had to have been feeling like, this is the best thing I've ever written, and what am I doing? This is crazy. This isn't even a script. Like, I bet he existed in two minds, which kind of came across as both Charlie and Donald, as super confident and completely insecure about his adaptation of The Orchid Thief. So it's like real life meeting fiction, meeting real life meeting fiction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing. And again, the whole idea of that, I'm gonna see if I can find it.
And it's really funny on top of all of that. If you just forget about all the how wildly original and inventive it is, it's just a really fucking funny movie. You know,
it's very funny. It's very everything. It's sort of like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, it's such a perfect film in terms of the acting, in terms of the structure, mm-hmm. in terms of what it says about film itself.
Yeah.
You know, there was an amazing series at our local like art house cinema where it was a bunch of movies about movies. So it was like Night for Day. It was
The Player.
Eight and a Half. They did do The Player. Uh-huh. They did The Muppet Movie, which we talked about this, I think, on Mini Crush.
Yeah.
I think this would have fallen into that category as well. So it's a movie about making movies, you know, but
in a bit of a different way.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's like it's also about the idea of adapting. Like, you know, that's what Charlie has to do mm-hmm. to make this work. He has to himself adapt and, like, use these devices that he despises.
Yes.
And, you know.
To adapt.
To adapt.
Uh-huh.
To make an adaptation about plants and insects and biological adaptations.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is this like ecosystem of ideas. Uh-huh. And
well, they had the whole brilliant thing with Charles Darwin, that whole sequence.
That's right.
And at the very beginning,
it's like a recre kind of thing, right? Like it's sort of like a dramatization of Darwin, and he's all like haggard.
Yeah. And Charlie at the beginning, he wants to start the story like from the Big Bang. Remember that whole sequence where he starts with the Big Bang and goes forward through his life when he's like trying to figure out his story?
Yeah.
And that's adaptation and natural selection.
Exactly.
It's just crazy how fucking genius this script is.
Yeah, and it's also, so, you know, taking it a step further, if it's natural selection, Charlie survived. You know, Charlie was the better brother.
I never thought
at the end
about
of the
that.
Day, right?
Like, wow. Yeah.
I mean, maybe not the better one, but he was the more like...
No, he's the one that lived.
He's the one that lived.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we should mention the sort of the female relationships that the brothers have. You know, Charlie is obviously deeply insecure, has this unrequited love with the Amelia character played by Kara Seymour.
Yeah, who's a violinist, I believe.
Yeah, which he never could, like, make the move and tell her how he feels and all that. He awkwardly tries to get Judy Greer, who plays the waitress in one of her early roles, on a date to the Orchid Show. She's creeped out by him, and that's really sad. And,
oh, it's such a sad scene. She's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because she's just really nice to him as a customer.
Right.
But he crosses that line in a gross threatening way, but just like, ugh.
But then her response is just soul shattering. Yeah.
And then, of course, the mirror image, you have, why do I keep saying mirror image?
Well, I mean,
it's not a mirror image.
Because a mirror image is reversed. So you've got like the.
But the mirror image means the same, right?
I don't know. I always think of it like if something's mirrored, then it's the opposite.
Oh, okay.
Because a reflection in a mirror is like flipped.
All right. So the mirror image, you have Donald, who, and that great scene where they go to the Being John Malkovich set, and John Cusack has on that really bad wig.
That's right.
Because they had to make it look like, you know, the movie.
Yeah.
And they're on the floor, whatever. Was it floor 4.5?
Yes.
Or whatever.
Little floor.
They're on that stage set, and Catherine Keener's in it. She's awesome and amazing. And he falls for Maggie Gyllenhaal, the Carolyn character.
Right.
And all of a sudden, because Donald just does a little set visit, Charlie comes home and he's hanging out with Catherine Keener and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and they're just fucking having a great time. And it's just like all of this stuff is just making Charlie feel worse.
Well, here's the thing, dude. Like, I can relate to this stuff. I, you know, I'm definitely pretty confident about the stuff that I do, but I also have that little mini nagging neuroses in the back of my head.
Sure. Insecurities.
That's the thing, though. That's the beauty of this movie, because everyone's sort of a combination of Charlie and Donald.
Yeah.
You know, it's somewhere in the middle is the real full human.
Uh-huh.
So it's like I can relate to both sides. I can relate to being way overly gregarious.
Right.
And like to the point where I just don't give a fuck. And I can also relate to like being, you know, having these ruminating thoughts and stuff too. It's like we're somewhere in the middle. I think we all probably can. That's why it's such a powerful thing.
I think we've all been in places where we were Charlie and over analytical to the point of debilitation about yourself.
Exactly.
And that's what he's doing the whole movie.
Yeah.
From describing his body to not getting any sleep and just like, it's just so great.
Yeah. And but then, you know, at the end of the day, he makes the thing.
Yeah.
And he's proud of it and he comes out of it. And then the movie ends with this. It just makes me tear up with the last lines. You know, even the last line is a joke. He says, I think I'll get Gerard Depardieu to play me in the movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it's happy together. The real, finally, we're hearing the Turtles version for the first time.
Yep.
And it's like you see the L.A. Lit
it's
up at night and
this
time lapse. And there are these flowers that are like, you know, swaying back and forth. And it's just that part of happy together that's like the most jubilant shit ever. Uh-huh. You know, that
God, it's so great. Such a great cue.
Yeah.
You know, that time lapse shot was it was at an intersection like right around the corner from where I lived in L.A. at the time. And I remember seeing it being like, holy shit, that's right there on Sunset.
Uh-huh.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So Susan Orlean had this to say. She had a script approval rights as the writer of The Orchid Thief. She was very much against it. She said this in 2012. After reading it, I was in complete shock. My first reaction was absolutely not. And they had to get my permission, and I just said, no, are you kidding me? This is going to ruin my career. And she said very wisely they didn't really pressure me. They just told me that everyone else had agreed, thought it was great, and somehow that emboldened me. It was certainly scary to see the movie for the first time, and it took a while for me to get over the idea that I had been insane to agree to it, but I love the movie now. And she said it's one of my favorite performances of Meryl Streep, and even though, like, that character, you know, they took it to this absurd degree and she gave them permission. It's like, all right, that's my name up there, Susan Orlean. Show me posing naked and show me doing drugs.
Yeah,
and
doing lines of green orchid dust. Yeah.
But she says, what I admire most about the film is very true to the book's themes, actually, of life and obsession. And there are also insights into things which are much more subtle in the book about longing and about disappointment. So somehow, even though it wasn't about the Orchid Thief, she feels like they managed to kind of capture the zhuzh.
But it also was. Like, that movie is in there. That story is in there.
It
at
is.
Least, you know, the initial parts of it and the parts that made for probably a really compelling New Yorker article.
Mm-hmm.
But to adapt an entire book of that into a film, I can't even imagine what that would look like.
Yeah.
So it's just genius. I don't know.
I mean, it's sort of this perfect little crazy experiment of a movie that just worked on every level.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it holds up. You know, it holds up to this day.
All right, Noel. Well, as you know, did we do it?
Yeah.
As you know, we finish with two segments.
Let's do it.
What Ebert said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
I read the Ebert. He was fond.
Four stars. Very fond of it. And I just pulled the very first thing he wrote in the article. What a bewilderingly brilliant and entertaining movie this is. A confounding story about orchid thieves and screenwriters, elegant New Yorkers and scruffy swamp rats, truth and fiction. Adaptation is a movie that leaves you breathless with curiosity as it teases itself with the directions it might take. To watch the film is to be actively involved in the challenge of its creation.
There you go.
Man.
That's smart. That nails it. Yeah, because it's about creation. It's about destruction. It's about like all of these very human themes. And yet it's like this total meta work where you feel like a participant in the whole thing. Or like you're somehow getting a peek behind the curtain of like what the real creative process is like, you know?
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah, so great. I'm so glad you picked this movie, man. When you told me, I was like, oh, fuck yeah, adaptation.
Good.
Man.
Yeah, I'm surprised no one's done it. It's such a classic.
Mm. And it also just occurred to me yesterday, I think, for the first time, that adaptation – it has a period at the end.
It does.
Like that's the official title of the movie is Adaptation, period.
I see that.
And you rarely get punctuation in a movie title. And I'm curious what that means.
I don't know. Maybe you just a reference to the fact that it was like typewritten, you know, or like with it.
Yeah,
I
maybe
don't know.
So.
Well, it's sort
the
of
great
you know,
Charlie Kaufman.
You know what's funny? I actually noticed something the other day. The David Bowie album Heroes is Heroes in parentheses. I mean, in quotation marks.
Oh, really?
And that's sort of part of it.
Boy, that
as
changes
well.
Everything.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like poking fun at the idea of heroes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I maybe with this, like an adaptation is sort of like up in the air. It's like, you know, oh, I'm taking something and turning it into something else.
Yeah.
This is sort of like adaptation, period. It's like, this is it. This
is the
adaptation.
Yeah, I think
or
so.
It's like all of the adaptations. I don't
it
know.
Is. All of the adaptations, period.
Yeah. It's definitive.
Man. And these two
Full
guys
stop.
It cemented each of these dudes to me. As like, I'm always going to see every Spike Jonze movie. I'm always going to see every Charlie Kaufman movie from here till the end of time, because they have earned that cred.
Yeah,
with these first two movies they did together.
And I mean, Jesus, man, Kaufman went
Synecdoche,
New York.
Yeah,
it's just, I mean, it makes sense.
That's a tough movie.
It's hard. It's like he said he wanted to make a horror movie about getting old. And that's what that is.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also a beautiful movie, but it's just so sad.
The one that gets me is Anomalisa.
That one's also very, very sad.
It's
beautiful, but it's much more nihilistic, both of those, than this. I feel like this one has a lot of like hope and like kind of ultimate goodness in it in a way. Whereas those two, I feel like, are very,
tough movies.
Very nihilistic and dark.
Yeah, but it's like once you see his body of work on paper, when you read through, like starting with Malkovich, what is going on in that guy's head? Like, what is being Charlie Kaufman like? Maybe this is as close as we're going to know.
Yeah.
Is seeing this movie.
Well, we haven't even mentioned the fact this is also incredibly autobiographical.
Yeah.
The whole movie. It's like, you know, you have no doubt that you're experiencing a good bit of truth in this, in terms of like his struggle and like his inner monologue and how crazy and like bold is it to put all that out there, you know, as a screenwriter, you know, there's that line in the movie where he's like, I've done the most self-indulgent, awful thing. I've written myself into the, you know, into the screenplay.
So good. Didn't Chris Cooper win an Academy Award for this? I feel like he did.
I think he already had won an Academy Award by this point for American Beauty.
Okay. But did he win one for this?
Let's see.
Yeah, here we go. 2003 Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, he deserved it.
Meryl Streep won the Golden Globe. I'm sure she was nominated. Chris Cooper also won the Golden Globe. I would think that this had to have been, if this was not nominated for script,
Best Adapted Screenplay.
It was. It was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah,
Charlie Kaufman and Charlie Kaufman. That's great.
Oh my God!
Because Donald Kaufman was on the credits.
That's right.
Pretty amazing. All right, Noel, and then we will finish with five questions. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
I think like one of those Don Bluth movies, like American Tale, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I actually, I do have a distinct memory of seeing Baron von Munchausen in the theaters, too.
Oh.
And I also have another distinct memory of one of those times I was traveling with my mom when I was really little, seeing the movie Mad Dog and Glory.
Sure. Uma Thurman.
And I remember, which is funny because she's also in Baron Munchausen.
Uh-huh.
But I remember there's a nude scene in it, and I was like with my mom, and I was really little, and it made me really like uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know my famous story from Greece. Saw that in the theater with my mom.
The pillow fight?
Pillow fight scene. Yeah. I asked to leave.
Yeah.
And we did.
Yeah.
It's very sweet. First R-rated movie.
I had a male babysitter when I was really, really young.
Uh-huh.
And he would rent all of the Schwarzenegger-y stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There was like a video store nearby. And I remember seeing a lot of those like through him.
Uh-huh.
I remember seeing like The Last Boy Scout with
Bruce Willis
and Damon Wayans, and I remember seeing like Total Recall, mm-hmm. and Predator and all those movies.
Yeah,
so it's all sort of a clump for me of those
right.
VHS action yeah. adventure sci-fi type movies.
Yeah, those used to all be rated R.
Yeah,
I feel like.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
Because of violence and language, they just didn't care.
Yeah.
Now they will tone it down just, I think, to reach a wider audience.
Big time.
But they didn't give a shit back then.
No.
It's kind of great. Did you walk out of a bad movie at all?
I don't believe that I ever have now.
Really?
I don't think I have. No.
Oh, wow. That's impressive.
I mean, nothing is popping out to me.
All right.
No.
Fair enough. All right. Number four, Noel, as you know, I try to tailor this to the guests now. What would be a good question for you?
I don't know, Chuck.
I'm going to go music. What band do you wish you could have been in?
Could have been in? Wow. I don't know. Zeppelin seemed fun.
All right. You want to be in Zeppelin?
Those Beatles? I would have loved to hang with those crazy, kooky kids.
Hey, there's no shame in picking those two. I thought you were going to say Smashing Pumpkins.
No. Fuck that guy. Billy Corgan's the worst.
I remember
seeing him. He really let me down.
I remember seeing him in L.A. when I lived there outside of the Warner Brothers music building.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first time I'd seen him up close. And I didn't know that he was that tall.
He's a very tall
man. It was just one of those things where rock stars usually aren't that tall.
No.
You know, they're usually little people, in fact.
Yeah, he's a big, gothy-looking tall dude.
Yeah, and he was talking to another guy. I was like, holy fuck. It's like, Billy Corgan's huge.
Yeah. He's really into wrestling, too, and as a—
What happened to
really,
him?
Really good buddies with Alex Jones.
What happened to him?
I think he was always kind of shitty, actually.
Well, that's probably
I
the
think,
case.
Yeah, I think he just, like, leaned— He just drank his own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I love them. But those first
so
two
great.
Albums were
Siamese
so great.
Dream
and Gish.
I mean, even Gish. And I loved Melancholy. I loved all the way up through Adore and stuff. I mean, I was so into them.
Yeah.
And then I started kind of seeing through the cracks and realizing, like, this guy is kind of a megalomaniacal douchebag.
Yeah.
And it crushed me, but it's fine.
I remember seeing the Lollapalooza where the Beastie Boys and Smashing Pumpkins were the last two bands. And the Beastie Boys blew the place up. I've never seen been a part of an audience experience like that in my life, as far as energy and hive mind energy going on.
I'm sure.
And they left the stage and the Smashing Pumpkins came on, and I remember feeling bad. People were leaving. Not because like, oh, I hate them. It was just such a letdown.
Well, it's like, it's over, man.
Yeah. And they just had it wrong, you know. They shouldn't have had the Beastie Boys second to last.
No.
And I remember feeling bad because Billy Corgan even referenced it on stage. He was like, you know, for those of you who are still here or something like that. And I was like, oh, man.
For those about to rock,
yeah.
We salute you.
All right. Led Zeppelin and the Beatles. Let's just
yeah,
go with that.
Yeah, uh-huh, at the same time.
Movie going 101. What's your deal?
Oh, you know, I'm super basic. I like a middle seat. I like to be centered.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle, back, not too far up front. I try to get there as early as I can.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of being able to reserve your seats. That's always
sure.
fun. I don't really get snacks.
Yeah.
I sneak stuff in sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
That old trick?
That's the old. Yeah, that's about it.
All right. Good stuff, dude.
Yeah, man.
This was great.
It was.
You know, maybe we'll just, if we ever come up short, we'll just have you on again.
We'll just do it again.
And
talk about another movie.
Yeah. I think it's great. Why not? Maybe we should do Being John Malkovich.
I would love that. I haven't seen that one in full in many years, so yeah. I need to revisit that one.
All right, buddy. See you Monday.
Yeah, Monday it is.
All right, everybody. That was Noel, my old buddy. I think that went pretty well. It was a lot of fun talking adaptation. He had a lot of great insights on that film and is clearly a true fan of Charlie Kaufman. I know he's one of Noel's favorite writers and filmmakers, as is Spike Jonze. So it's cool. Noel's a bit younger than me, but we see eye to eye, and it's always I feel like we have a lot in common. So it's always fun to sit down with people with common interests and creative pursuits and common tastes, and especially if they're a little bit younger and you can get a different perspective like I got from Noel. So it's a lot of fun. Thanks to Noel, and thanks to producer Ramsey for getting this one in and out of the can and on the internet airwaves. So, hope you enjoyed it. And until next week, why don't you go out and adapt a story on your own? See how that goes. It's hard. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.